Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
To quote Sir Winston Churchill, "We make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give." Turns out we also make something pleasant go off in our brains when we give, which may be one reason some of the country's richest businessmen are promising their fortunes to charity. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms committed to helping business owners and in-house counsel find local, pre-qualified legal counsel for over 20 years. Meritas.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. It is the 9th day of December. We'll look at what giving does to our brains later in the show. But first, the give and take on Capitol Hill over tax cuts. President Barack Obama and congressional Democrats spent another day haggling over the costs and benefits of a compromise. It would delay the expiration of all the Bush tax cuts for 2 years, extend unemployment benefits for 1 year, and it includes new tax breaks for both workers and business investment. Today, the president said the compromise is good for the economy.
And every economist that I've talked to or that I've read over the last couple of days acknowledges that this agreement would boost economic growth in the coming years and has the potential to create millions of jobs.
We wondered how that could be, since most of this merely extends the situation we've already had for 10 years. Marketplace's John Dimsdale joins us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hello, Tess.
So help us understand how this compromise can create jobs.
Well, you're right. The Bush income tax levels have been around for 10 years now, and they haven't been doing much to create jobs, and neither have those extended unemployment benefits that expired at the beginning of December.
Yeah.
But economists do see a stimulative effect from the 2% payroll tax reduction, along with those business breaks for investments in new plant and equipment. Chris Varvaris at Macroeconomic Advisors has crunched the numbers, and he found that just those two changes, along with the one-year extension of unemployment, would generate 700,000 extra jobs.
The primary mechanism by which this boosts economic activity is by putting money in people's pockets who you expect to spend it.
And it's the money in those people's pockets that will generate some jobs, but it's indirect. It first creates some demand for products, and then companies to meet that demand start looking around to hire and investing in new plant and equipment, which should create some jobs.
But as you mentioned, the payroll tax is only 1 year. What happens then?
Well, then job creation lasts only as long as the tax benefits, according to Varvaris. Unless the economy gets a kick that helps it generate more jobs on its own, he expects the unemployment rate to return after a year to almost the level that it's at today. Same with those investment tax credits. Those are 100% write-off next year, but 50% in 2012, then they disappear. But even though they are temporary, Brookings economist Martin Bailey says that, too, should give companies more comfort to hire more people.
Are you really trying to bring forward some of the spending by encouraging businesses to invest this year or next year rather than putting it off and waiting? And it is a substantial sort of tax benefit to expense all of that equipment.
But, you know, Bailey says there is one worry that might take some of the edge off of the job creation from the compromise. If consumers and companies worry about the higher deficits and the taxes that are going to be needed in the future to bring them under control, they might just sock away their tax breaks and not make those investments that are needed to create jobs. But all in all, Bailey says he thinks the compromise still is a net plus for the economy.
At least the two parts of it that are new.
That's right. Just the investment business breaks and the 2% payroll tax reduction.
All right. Marketplace's John Dimsdale helping us to understand how these tax cuts are going to affect jobs. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tess.
Mark Zuckerberg, Warren Buffett, and Bill Gates have many things in common, not least of which is the fact that their wealth is tallied in billions. They've also signed a pledge to give away the majority of their money. Zuckerberg and 16 other billionaires are among the newest to sign on to the effort. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins looks at what they're really pledging and what it buys them beyond the PR buzz.
Let's face it, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg could use a little good PR right now, since he's not always done so well with the ladies, at least according to the movie about him.
You're going to go through life thinking that girls don't like you because you're a nerd. And I want you to know from the bottom of my heart that that won't be true. It'll be because you're...
We scratched that next word. So maybe Zuckerberg's joining something called the Giving Pledge to generate nicer words about himself. Billionaires Bill Gates and Warren Buffett launched the effort to get the super rich to give away more than half their wealth. But much of this wealth is tied up in investments. So how real are these pledges?
Probably 100% of it is not real, because much of it is paper money.
Betsy Zeidman is a senior research fellow at the Milken Institute. Her chairman, Michael Milken, who made a fortune off junk bonds, also signed on to the pledge.
But I think that even if it isn't all real, it's still, ultimately, it is still a significant amount of money.
Daniel Borokoff at the American Institute of Philanthropy says much of the money will go to private foundations that only have to give out about 5% of their endowment a year.
So this may not be helping out as much as we would like to think that it would be helping out.
But one thing's for sure, these donors won't end up in the poorhouse. If Warren Buffett, for one, gave away 99% of his wealth, that would still leave him with a tidy $450 million. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, another mixed day as traders wait to see what actually happens with the tax cut vote. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You may remember last week we did a story about the return of the tech bubble. Marketplace's Steve Henn made the case that this time things are different. Unlike the IPO craze of the late 90s, big companies, including Google, are sitting on mountains of cash and driving up the value of startups like Groupon. Well, a couple of tech IPOs caught our attention this week. So as they like to say in Congress, we are giving Steve a chance to revise and extend his remarks.
It looks like Wall Street may have found a simple new recipe for high-flying IPOs. Just take one part tech, add one part China, shake well, and pop. Two Chinese internet companies went public on the U.S. stock markets yesterday, and the results were intense. Youku.com, which streams TV shows in China and has never turned a profit, almost tripled in value and is up again today. And Dangdang, an e-commerce bookseller, has doubled its stock price in less than 48 hours. Kate Mitchell is at Scale Venture Partners.
The institutional investors are comfortable on the U.S. exchange, and they're very interested in owning part of the China growth story.
Darren Fabrick runs IPOX Capital Management and sells a mutual fund that invests only in IPOs. Yesterday, he bought a little piece of Dangdang.
There's been investor appetite, especially in America, for Chinese companies. People looking for growth. They don't see it here, so they're willing to pay up.
While both Dangdang and Youku have expanding revenues and are leaders in China's online marketplace, Fabrick says these are still very high-risk investments.
We like to say Chinese IPOs can be hazardous to your wealth.
One study found that just adding the word China to the name of a company can move its stock price up 30%. Now Wall Street's adding tech to that mix, and it's getting a powerful, intoxicating, and bubbly punch. Just watch out for the hangover. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
UN-led talks on climate change are wrapping up in Cancun, Mexico. Negotiators are hung up on the same issues that bedeviled them last year and the year before: money. One question is how much the biggest polluters, mostly rich countries, should pay poor countries to mitigate the effects of all that pollution. Marketplace's Scott Tong has our story.
200 miles from resort Mexico is actual Mexico. This is Tabi, a community of indigenous Mayan farmers. 42-year-old Anadina Nawat Abam takes a spoonful of cornmeal, dollops it onto a piece of plastic, and pats it flat. It's a tortilla,
Everything revolves around corn for us small farmers. It's what most people in this region do, grow corn.
Corn feeds her animals and her four children. But Mexican officials say corn harvests here are down by at least 50% compared to 15 years ago.
Lower production means we don't always eat three times a day, sometimes twice or just once. Still, no one goes hungry.
She considers one meal a day enough. The husbands who grow the corn blame climate change. They say the rains are less predictable and dry spells are coming more often. Fact is, they don't know the science or the endless policy debates in the halls of Cancun. But to 48-year-old farmer Francisco Tun Put, something is changing.
20 years ago, we'd have years with so much corn we could sell the surplus. We don't have those years anymore.
What the scientists do know, with confidence, is that global temperatures are already rising. Heat wilts plants. And it warms the atmosphere, which then sucks more water out of the soil. And, we'll spare you the details, the experts think drought-prone areas like this will likely get more drought-prone. So the challenge to the Mayan farmers? Produce more corn. They just started using fertilizer, as in chicken poop, so that's a start. The quantum leap would be storing water, instead of simply waiting for it to fall.
I wish the government could help me buy a well. Then I could grow corn and even other crops, like tomatoes.
That's where money comes in, and the bureaucrats at the Cancun summit, the now knocking heads over climate change funding, among other issues. And baked into the Kyoto Protocol is the notion that the historic emitters, the rich countries, send money to the poor countries. Antonio Hill at Oxfam argues the farmers deserve it.
These people are not responsible for climate change. Those countries that are responsible and also able to help have a responsibility to both stop climate change, but also to start helping them avoid the worst impacts of what's already inevitable.
Avoiding climate effects is not something there's necessarily a market for. Sure, the private sector will bet on bankable products like solar panels and electric cars, but helping farmers in Mexico? No return on investment.
So therefore, it needs to be led with public investments so that communities like this can count on a stream of resources to then go on and become a more productive part of the economy.
Even if governments chip in money, will it trickle down to places like this? The international finance guys in suits would decide who's deserving and how much. And there's always the corruption question, local officials siphoning off their own share. These struggling Mayan corn growers don't control any of that. But they can sing and they can pray. This is a Christian community. This hymn is called "We Will Worship God If He Comes to Us." In the community of Tabi, Mexico, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, why big corporations are offering their charitable dollars to nonprofits that get out the vote.
We feel like that provides a very good halo for the brand.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street seesawed today and ended mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 2 points, closing essentially flat at 11,370. The Nasdaq, however, climbed 7 points, 0.25% to end at 2616. And the S&P 500 rose 4 points, 0.33% to finish at 1233. AIG gained nearly 13%. The Treasury Department said it would unload the stake it has left in the insurer as quickly as it can. Goodyear Tire and Rubber made 10% worth of tire marks after Bank of America raised its rating. DuPont burned off more than 1% after analysts said the bottom end of its 2011 forecast trailed their estimates. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.2%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department tells us how much the U.S. imported and exported in October with the release of its International Trade Report. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the world. And Eco Build America, a conference on sustainable building, wraps up in the nation's capital. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. State and local governments are trying just about anything these days to get their budgets out of hock. Arizona is cutting back on funding for medical transplants. Cities are inviting corporations to slap their names on everything from subway stops to playgrounds. The latest sign of desperation? New York City wants private hospitals to pay up to $1 million a year to have their ambulances respond to 911 calls. New York's bravest don't have enough ambulances, so 25 city hospitals help pick up the slack. Needless to say, this move is opening some fresh wounds. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
It's a sound you hear a lot if you live in New York. To many private hospitals, that now sounds like a bill for $1 million or more.
We anticipate this would cost us about $1.5 million.
Terry Lynham is with North Shore LIJ Health Systems, which operates several New York hospitals and dozens of ambulances. Under the new plan, when a 911 call gets passed to one of its ambulances, North Shore would have to pay.
Our hope is that there will be efforts made to reduce this burden.
Some hospitals are threatening to stop taking 911 calls. Dr. Lewis Marshall chairs emergency medicine at Brookdale Medical Center. He says the new fees would cost his Brooklyn hospital nearly $300,000 a year. Marshall says if hospitals like his opt out, residents will suffer.
It would reduce the availability of ambulances. I think that the waiting times for ambulances would go up.
The city says private hospitals benefit by being part of the 911 network and should share in the cost. More and more cities are charging fees for emergency services as they scramble to plug holes in their budgets. Chris Haney is the director of research at the National League of Cities.
The emergency services budgets tend to be a part of larger public safety budgets, and those are oftentimes the single largest category of expenditures in city governments.
Haney says many cities have started charging residents for 911 calls, at times hundreds of dollars for a ride to the hospital. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. For Marketplace.
Rumors have been swirling for months in Washington about a split in the health insurance industry. It's not about who covers what. It's about who should represent the interests of huge insurance companies versus smaller and mid-sized ones on Capitol Hill. Word from Kaiser Health News today is that the five largest are shopping around for their own PR firm. We asked Gregory Warner at the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia to parse it out for us.
Last year, the insurance lobbying group America's Health Insurance Plans quietly spent $86 million to oppose the health care law, while at the same time publicly supporting reform. Now the lobbying focus has changed, no longer about voting down the law.
It's influencing and tweaking the implementation and, in some cases, perhaps stalling implementation.
Sheila Krumholtz directs the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington. As the strategy for lobbying has changed, a rift may have formed inside the lobbying group.
The interest that a smaller insurance company may have might very well diverge with the interest of a larger insurance company.
Ron Pollack is executive director of Families USA, an advocacy organization for healthcare consumers. The insurers lobbying group declined to comment, while large insurers Cigna and WellPoint did not return calls or emails. Pollack says those large insurance companies, though, are looking to how states set the rules of the exchanges, where those of us without insurance will have to buy it in 2014. Large insurers may want states to design those exchanges to reward efficiencies of scale in ways that keep smaller insurers out of the running.
So this is a continuing drama.
J.B. Silvers teaches healthcare finance at Case Western Reserve University. He used to run a small insurance company. He says the interests of big insurers are clear.
The they're going to get 26 million more enrollees, and they want to bargain now for better rules.
What was a fight over politics may be turning into a fight for more customers. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
This week, we're looking at how charitable giving is changing. Nonprofits are increasingly using social media and technology to connect with donors and volunteers. To persuade someone to give money or time to your cause, you have to connect with something the potential donor likes or believes in. Commentator Jonah Lehrer says it's all about an emotional response in our brains.
The first thing to note about giving away money is that it feels really good. For instance, several brain scanning experiments demonstrate that donating to a worthy cause leads to activation in the dopamine reward pathway. It's the same part of the brain that's turned on when we have sex or eat a slice of chocolate cake. In fact, there's typically more reward-related activity when we donate money than when we receive an equivalent amount. Giving is literally better than getting, at least from the perspective of the brain. But this generosity comes with a catch. Yes, we have altruistic instincts. Still, these instincts come with some real blind spots. Consider the work of Paul Slovic, a psychologist at the University of Oregon. He told undergraduates about a starving child named Rokia. She lived in a crumbling refugee camp in Africa. His students acted with impressive generosity. They saw her emaciated body and haunting brown eyes, and they donated, on average, about $2.50 to save the children. However, when a second group of students were provided with a list of statistics about starvation in Africa, like the fact that more than 5 million children are malnourished, the average donation was 50% lower. At first glance, this makes no sense. We should give away more money when we are informed about the true scope of the problem, not less. Why do we do this? The depressing statistics leave us cold, even when they are truly terrible. That's because our emotions can't comprehend suffering on such a massive scale. This is why we are riveted when one child falls down a well, but turn a blind eye to the millions of people who die every year for lack of clean water. And yet, the good news is that we are still wired to care about each other. We feel pleasure when someone else feels better. So give away some money. It'll make you feel good. And maybe give a little extra to that cause that doesn't make you feel anything at all.
Jonah Lehrer is the author of How We Decide. So how do you decide when to give? Send us your comments. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. So we know that giving is tied to a feeling of pleasure, kind of like gambling. Well, it turns out the next big thing in philanthropy turns giving money into a type of contest, prize philanthropy, if you will. Name brands like Pepsi and American Express put up the money, millions of dollars, and then they let the public decide which worthy causes should get it. Backers say it's helping smaller nonprofits compete for those funds, but as Joel Rose reports, skeptics think the brands themselves are the real winners.
Back in February, Pepsi announced on the Today Show that it was giving away $20 million through a philanthropy contest on its website.
Pepsi, one of NBC's longtime advertisers, is launching Pepsi Refresh, a campaign to foster innovation for the social good.
I didn't even finish my cup of coffee, and I thought, we've got to do this.
That's Mark Neidig. He's the CEO of the Kansas Cancer Research Foundation. It's a small organization in Erie, Pennsylvania, that supports early-stage cancer research. Pepsi is giving out $250,000 to the causes that get the most votes in any given month. So Neidig basically put the rest of his operation on hold to focus on the contest.
When you become obsessed with the campaign, you literally are watching it around the clock. You wake up in the middle of the night and you check it.
Neidig emailed his supporters every day to remind them to vote for his project on Pepsi's website and on Facebook. But that kind of dedication can easily turn into overexposure, says Derek Feldman. He's the CEO of Achieve, a consulting firm that works with nonprofit organizations.
So organizations really need to decide for themselves, how do we make sure that our donors don't get what we call donor fatigue?
In the end, Mark Neidig's determination paid off. Kansas won $250,000 and a lot more attention for its cause.
The Pepsi Refresh Project really gave us a new platform to communicate on a national scale what we're doing.
Which supporters say is exactly what contests like this are designed to do. Michael Smith works at the Case Foundation, one of the first to organize online philanthropy contests. At their best, he says these competitions help spread the wealth to organizations that wouldn't stand much chance in the traditional grant-making process.
We all sit often in the same circles of people with the same thinking, the same backgrounds. And if you kind of stay in those stale silos, you're never going to innovate. So the idea is bringing new people, new voices, new talents to the table.
But skeptics think these high-profile philanthropy contests have some other less noble goals.
It's advertising. It's a cheap way to get a lot of advertising.
James English is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania who's written a book about the history of philanthropic prizes and corporate contests.
These things always seem to be crafted with an eye toward what's going to make a splash, what's going to be a story, what are journalists going to be interested in, rather than necessarily what is really needed at this time. What are the problems?
But supporters of philanthropy contests don't see a contradiction between doing good and doing well for themselves. Pepper Evans-Rukis is with American Express, which recently launched its own contest and an accompanying ad campaign.
We feel like that provides a very good halo for the brand. And for people who are not card members, hopefully it will make us seem more relevant to them as a brand so that when they start to consider a new financial product, we're in their consideration set.
There's no doubt that people are paying attention. Rukis says the American Express Members Project has more than 500,000 fans on Facebook. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. By Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. And by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit Putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, one that is hard to imagine for millions of Americans still looking for jobs. Believe it or not, Americans' overall wealth grew more than 2% in the third quarter. Household net worth is nearly $55 trillion, up from $49 trillion 2 years ago in the depths of the Great Recession. A positive development until you consider this. We need another 20% gain to get back to where we were pre-recession. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 2 points, closing flat. The Nasdaq climbed 7 points, 0.25%, and the S&P 500 rose 4 points, 0.33%. Our editors include Ben Adair, John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune into the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, Iowa state budget cuts could mean an end to sabbaticals for professors who give the plan an F.
The first sabbatical that I took probably led directly to what's now, you know, over $100 million in research funding.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.